Welcome to Why So Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Austin-based singer-songwriter Ali Tadros will be in Dayton tonight, performing at Ghostlight Coffee. Kaleidoscope host Juliet Fromholt spoke with her by phone to talk about her new album, The Fits. That's coming up later in the program. Dionisi Alaprentis is a research economist in the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. In a recent study, he found that not only has poverty increased in the United States, it has also become more concentrated. We'll talk to him about that. And later in the program, we'll check in with Bill Felker and Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, some of the week's news. One of the key provisions of Governor John Kasich's budget is the plan to hike the tax on big companies, creating a boom in oil and natural gas drilling and exploration in Ohio. But State House correspondent Karen Kassler reports that though Republicans control the governor's office in both chambers of the legislature, the proposal could be facing an uphill battle.
Governor Kasich has been pushing an increase in the tax on oil and natural gas drillers for a year, saying that what he has called a reform in the severance tax could be used to offset the income tax cut that he's talked about since he launched his campaign for governor. The severance tax increase was stripped out of his budget update last year, and Kasich said at the end of 2012 that after looking at the impact of severance taxes in other states, he would make a severance tax increase a cornerstone of his upcoming budget.
There is no danger that people are running away. And since we've been talking about this, they've continued to invest billions. I mean, we got $2-3 billion invested in this state. Secondly, they have very high severance taxes, and they pass that on to us. So we pay to get the, keep their taxes low, which is just unbelievable to me.
Seated right next to Governor Kasich at that event in December was House Speaker Bill Batchelder, who was also asked about the severance tax.
Looking at other taxes, as we are going to do, I think we want to be very careful before we impose that. Will our caucus vote for it? I think that they will. I don't think there's any question about it.
But now, the 4% severance tax on big oil and gas drillers is in the $63 billion two-year budget to help fund a 20% cut in the income tax for all Ohioans and a 50% income tax cut for small businesses. And Speaker Batchelder is sounding a lot less welcoming toward the severance tax increase.
We certainly don't want to discourage people from coming here. And I've made that point strongly with my good friend, the governor, that, you know, let's do everything we can to encourage people to come create jobs. And if we do that, then I think we're going to have a source of taxation at some point down the road that would be very helpful. But not now, I don't think.
Batchelder says he thinks the governor's claims of billions of dollars in investment in Ohio by drillers is, using the speaker's word, optimistic. And he says the income tax cut could still happen through cuts in other spending. Batchelder says the Republican caucus he leads, which includes 60 of the 99 House members, is leaning toward opposing the severance tax. But Majority Whip Cheryl Grossman of Grove City near Columbus may have already made up her mind.
I am opposed to the severance tax as it's been presented. I think it is so important for us to embrace those 200,000 jobs that are predicted to be here by 2015, and I think we need to be extremely cautious that we don't do anything to discourage the potential that can come here to the state.
Also in the anti-severance tax camp is Senator Troy Balderson of Zanesville in eastern Ohio, the epicenter of the oil and gas drilling boom.
It's going to hurt local producers, and I know that that's talked about how they won't be affected in this legislation, but they are affected. And that's who we need to focus on. That's where my jobs are that are there right now, my local companies.
But not all Republican lawmakers are leaning against the severance tax. Senator Bill Seitz is a longtime conservative lawmaker from Cincinnati.
I have not been a stalwart opponent of the governor's proposal on severance tax. I think in the main, it is a reasonable proposal. The fact of the matter is, these folks have spent billions of dollars to buy the rights to explore for oil and gas in Ohio. They are not going to walk away from that investment.
Kasich's position has been boosted by polls showing a growing majority of Ohioans support a tax on oil and gas drillers. And when the governor unveiled his budget with the severance tax in it, He warned those who oppose it that this may be the last chance to have some control over it.
At some point it's going to happen. It's either going to happen through this or it's going to happen on a ballot. One way or the other, it's going to happen.
Republican opposition to the severance tax increase, as well as to the Medicaid expansion, could put Democratic lawmakers, who are in the minority in both the House and the Senate, in a surprisingly important position. The governor would need their votes to get the budget, as it is, passed. Most Democrats support a severance tax increase, but want the revenue to go to local governments and schools to offset cuts in the governor's last budget. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Ohio Secretary of State John Husted paid a visit to Clark County on Thursday. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that Husted presented a special award to a local manufacturing company.
Enon's CPEX Incorporated has locations around the world, including China. Its Clark County location is the company's headquarters for the North American and South American markets. The company makes pumps used in the food industry and also for power plants, oil and gas producers, and municipal water treatment facilities. Husted's visit to CPEX was to present a special recognition award to the company for deciding to expand its Clark County operation and create 38 new jobs in the process. Husted says that the company's growth is a good sign for Ohio's manufacturing industry.
There's some really good things going on with advanced manufacturing technology related to oil and gas, and certainly the food industry is another driver of what they do, which is a very positive thing. And so there's a reason for hope that as the government is having to back up on what they're spending, that private sector investment will fill that void.
Husted says that Ohio has worked hard politically to make the state more attractive to do business in.
We have really overhauled our tax system in this state from being one of the most expensive tax systems for businesses to operate in to one of the best, and that's good for them. But the state's also been a partner in helping secure financing for these expansions, and so there is a little role for government of being involved and a little role for government of getting out of the way that's been a formula for helping companies like CPEX grow in our state.
Husted says CPEX is a company that has a bright future in Ohio.
They're just into this new expansion, and they're already talking that there might be another one down the road, potentially. No promises, but that things are going so well that they may have to actually expand again.
CPEX spent $8 million to add 50,000 square feet to its Enon facility. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Dionisi Alaprantis is a research economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. He is primarily interested in applied econometrics, labor and urban economics, and education. His current work investigates neighborhood effects on education and labor market outcomes. In a recent study, he found that not only has poverty increased in the United States, but it has also become more concentrated. We spoke to him about that.
This is something that, in general, I'd say social scientists have been paying more attention to really since the 1980s. It's really been influenced by the work of this sociologist, William Julius Wilson. So he studied Chicago neighborhoods and looked at their evolution between 1970 and 1980 in a very famous study. And he found that in that decade, there were kind of the emergence of these neighborhoods where there were just a really highly concentrated poverty there, or, you know, really high unemployment rates in ways that there just hadn't been before. And people started paying attention to this because the thought is that, you know, if people behave differently in different social environments, then you could imagine that depending on what kind of neighborhood you live in, it might impact your outcomes. And when I'm talking about outcomes, I'm talking about things like, you know, your labor market outcomes, whether or not you're employed or not, what kind of wages you get, your educational outcomes, so whether you graduate high school or college. You know, the kind of things that we think matter that, you know, really impact people's lives. So people have really been focusing a lot more on thinking about kind of how people are geographically distributed in neighborhoods, in cities. And so what we actually measure here is something a little bit different. So people have studied concentrated poverty. So that's thinking about neighborhoods where there's just a lot of, a higher degree of poor people than in other neighborhoods. So thinking about neighborhoods like 20, 30, or 40% poverty rates. But what we're studying is actually the concentration of poverty within an MSA. So it's not just one neighborhood in particular, but what we're trying to look at is thinking about within an MSA, how different is the typical neighborhood of a poor person versus the typical neighborhood environment of a non-poor person? And we're trying to characterize how different those are across MSAs and how much that's changed over time.
Tell us a little bit about those differences that you found.
So what we found is that over the past decade, that increased considerably. So the typical neighborhood of a poor person versus the typical neighborhood of a non-poor person, the difference in the poverty rates in those neighborhoods increased pretty dramatically. And what we really found that I thought was interesting is that, you know, the biggest kind of increases happened for the MSAs that had the lowest concentration in 2000. So really what you see is kind of an across-the-board increase, so that in our cities now, on average, poor people and non-poor people are living in more different types of neighborhoods than before. So some other things that we found, if you look at the top of the list in the cities with the highest concentration of poverty, those tend to be kind of northern industrial cities or Rust Belt cities. And the other thing that we found, being in the 4th District here, we're really interested in what's happening here. And when we looked at 4th District cities, what we found is in 2000, we only had two of the top 15 cities. But that changed, and in the past decade now, we're up to having four of the top 15 cities. And pretty much with the exception of Dayton and Pittsburgh, all of the cities in the 4th District that we looked at had had pretty big increases, other than, I guess, also Toledo and Cleveland, but they were already very high in the rankings. So when you look at all the other cities that were lower down in the rankings, pretty much all of them, with the exception of Dayton and Pittsburgh, moved up the rankings considerably in the past decade.
And we certainly want to talk to you about those two cities, what, especially Dayton. What separates those out from the pack, I guess? Is it a matter of gentrification, or what's at play there?
So that's actually a really good question. And that's something that this study itself doesn't really speak to, but it's something that we're going to be looking at in kind of future work. So anything I'd say now would be highly speculative, but it could be something like, say, you know, industry composition, manufacturing. You know, I could think of a lot of different reasons why that might be the case, that Dayton and Pittsburgh seem to fare better than other places. Something that we're going to be looking at in the future is trying to think about, so what exactly is it that's driving the concentration of poverty within these MSAs?
I'm curious about the economic crash leading into 2008 and how that affected your figures or your findings.
So, yes, the concentration of poverty within MSAs we found to be generally correlated with the overall poverty level in that city. But, you know, we can think about that whether it's in terms of the level or the change over that period. So it's correlated with both of those things, as well as, say, the unemployment rate, so things that we would, you know, kind of imagine impacting this. So the fact that overall poverty went up, the thing is, it's not necessarily the case that if overall poverty goes up, that the concentration of poverty is going to increase as well. So we can't kind of take that as a given, because if it affected, say, you know, non-poor neighborhoods, you know, all different types of neighborhoods the same way, then we might see, you know, not much of a change in the concentration of poverty within these MSAs. But in fact, we do see that growth. So, you know, we think this is something that's obviously, you know, strongly related to the Great Recession. But I think it is also important to point out that the first 2 years of data in our sample, in the most recent sample, are years that weren't really affected by the Great Recession. So if it started in December of 2007, essentially we have 2006 and 2007, 2 years that were largely unaffected. So it will definitely be interesting going forward to look at the newer data as they come out and see, you know, just how is this going to get worse? Is it going to get better? It'll be something interesting to look at.
So you say that one of the key issues going forward will be whether these rates revert back to pre-recession levels, and then it'll be up to policymakers to address that and determine what programs might help in this situation. Do you have an idea of what some of those programs might look like?
So broadly speaking, I think there are kind of two types of approaches to thinking of addressing this issue. So the first one is thinking about kind of big investments in these kinds of communities. So that's maybe in terms of education or maybe in terms of employment. And there's a lot of other, you know, there's a lot of programs that are attempting to do that. The thing about it is, again, it's a little bit tricky because those programs don't always work the way that they're intended. Sometimes some are more effective than others. But that's one of the approaches, is to think about investing in communities that have a high degree of poverty. The other is to try to have higher income people move in without forcing out the original residents that are already there. So that's, I'm thinking about kind of things like, say, HUD is working on trying to encourage mixed income communities. And that's kind of the other kind of broad approach to addressing this issue.
Denise Alaprontis is a research economist in the research department of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. Denise, thanks for speaking with us today.
All right. Thank you.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Austin-based singer-songwriter Ali Tadros will be in Dayton tonight performing at Ghostlight Coffee in support of her new album, The Fits. Kaleidoscope host Juliet Fromholtz caught up with Tadros earlier this week. Here's their conversation.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started playing. I was reading a little bit of your bio, and I understand you kind of had a moment where you decided, yes, this is what I want to do. Can you describe a little bit about how you got started?
Yeah, it's crazy because I did not grow up playing music at all. I didn't buy my first guitar until I was 18, and it's because I had a crush on a dude who played at an open mic, and I think I got kind of jealous. I sort of stumbled my way through learning how to play while I was traveling, when I was 18 and 19. When I was in college, I was studying Middle Eastern politics, and I was pretty unhappy. And I was actually really sort of inspired by a blog that I read that Tucker Max wrote. And he had talked about a girl who he knew had been diagnosed with a terminal illness, or malignant cancer, I guess. And before the diagnosis, she hated her life. She had a job she couldn't stand. She didn't travel, didn't like her friends. And then when she had no idea how long she had to live, she made a bunch of changes. Eventually, she beat the cancer, and she said that it was the best thing that ever happened to her. And in the article, he says, imagine being diagnosed with a terminal illness or malignant cancer. What would you do and what would you change? And when I read that, the first thing I thought was, well, I wouldn't be studying Middle Eastern politics. I was terribly depressed at the time. I wouldn't be in New York where I was at school in the freezing cold. I would be living in Austin, Texas. I'd be playing songs on Sixth Street, and I'd be doing volunteer work. And at that point in time, I'd never written my first song. And the next thing he said in the article was, well, why are you waiting for cancer? And that was my aha moment, the first moment that I realized I wanted to do music. And a few weeks later, I sort of accidentally wrote my first song. And as I was on the train headed back to school to take a final, I knew I was done. I skipped the final, and I started playing that summer.
I've been talking to a lot of musicians recently, and we've been talking about kind of that sometimes the easiest way to go is when you don't give yourself a plan B and you just go and you say you have to make this work. Is that kind of how you felt when you decided, okay, music is it?
Definitely. Yeah, I couldn't have a net. And every single time I tried to make a net for myself, it just, like, the universe didn't let it happen. You know, I would pick up a job on the side, and I would get gigs, you know, every single night at the exact time I was supposed to be working. But yeah, I've definitely put myself in the position many times where I had to figure out a way to make it work. And, you know, we're resilient people. We usually do.
Going from, you know, that first song that you wrote, you know, getting ready for a final, what's your writing process like now? Do you start off with lyrics? Do you just start off, you know, noodling around on the guitar? What's your process?
It's always different, but typically it's a combination of starting with the guitar or the melody, and then I play by ear for the most part. So I'll find a guitar part that I like and just start singing a melody over it. And there's usually an intention or a feeling behind it, and lyrics start building, and I usually just try and stick with my instincts as much as I can. I'll get out as much of the song as I can and record a demo, and then I've gotten into the process of going for runs after I start recording demos, and I'll just start listening to the demo over and over, and then that's how the editing process goes. I'll get home after my run and start, you know, like pulling out my rhyming dictionary and trying to make sure that all the metaphors fit, you know. It's like it's almost like a piece of architecture or something. The foundation is always the melody and the guitar part and the metaphor. And then I just build from there.
And I know that you've been touring around quite a bit, doing a lot of traveling. Do you find that that travel, being in, you know, different cities and countries and places, that that has an influence on what you're writing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, just genre-wise, you know, the music that I'm surrounded by constantly, I'm sure on a subconscious level, has affected the style, whether I'm writing, you know, folky or country or stuff or, you know, weird Eastern Bloc type music. But, yeah, I was just in Canada for this crazy house concert tour. We toured Alberta and Saskatchewan for 2 weeks, and we played in a bunch of houses that didn't even have addresses. They were like GPS coordinates. And that, like, definitely informed this sort of solitude and quiet that came about my writing. It was very peaceful songs for a change.
What is that like, doing, you know, a house show or these really intimate small venues where, you know, you can be face-to-face with an audience member and kind of have that connection with people one-on-one? What's that experience like for you as a performer?
It's amazing. You learn so much about yourself in two different ways. First of all, especially when you're playing in somebody's house, because you're in their space, there's this inherent trust that's there. Like, you know, a lot of times they'll just let us in and they're not even the house yet, and, you know, they don't even know who we are. But typically, especially after we've played and we've put ourselves in this vulnerable position in their living room, they just open up to us, and, you know, we get to hear people's life stories so much of the time, and, you know, they'll tell us about their problems or their dreams or, you know, their families, and I feel like I've learned so much about life in those settings and people's living rooms after shows, you know, and, like, half of it is bourbon, the other half is just situational because, you know, we're in their space. And then sometimes it can be a little exhausting because you get so invested in people, I guess, and it's every single day, you know. So it's every now and again I have to run away for a little while. I think that's why I run, to get some space.
Now, I know that kind of on the flip side of the super intimate house show, you've got a music video that's been getting a lot of attention. And I have to say, I love it. It's so charming. And just in reading your bio and listening to your music, it's like it seems just so fitting. Did you get to have a hand in sort of the crafting of the visual part of that story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was super involved in the process. And, we had a great team. I mean, it was such an indie video. I mean, like, the budget was pretty much non-existent. Almost everything in that video was donated. The girls in the video, the two little girls, I actually babysat. So I borrowed them for the shoot. And the concept came about because the bus that's in the graphics part of it broke down the morning of the shoot. And originally we were supposed to be driving around with the band in the bus playing the song, and we had to come up with an alternate version because we literally pushed it to a corner in Brooklyn in front of somebody's porch. We pulled up the green screen. We shot, you know, the sequence. And then we thought, okay, well, we have to come up with something, you know, something that has to do with a green screen and an adventure. And, we thought it was fun to make it a Reading Rainbow little girl's imagination kind of thing. The whole thing took like 6 or 7 months. The director was my neighbor, and he and I went back and forth almost daily, you know, working on the animations and everything.
And what does the rest of the year look like? I saw that you're heading over to the UK in May. What are your plans for the summer? Continuing touring?
Yeah. I just wrapped up a West Coast tour. I've got a tour down to South by Southwest, and then I'll tour back up through the Midwest. Early summer, I'll probably go out to the West Coast again, and the plan is to shuffle back and forth between touring and recording the next album.
Is there anything else on the horizon that people should keep their eyes open for? Are you going to do another video for any of the songs on the Fitz, or are you going to kind of roll with this one for a while for the video for Sweet on Me?
Well, we're definitely still pushing the Sweet on Me video, but yes, I actually just shot the second video yesterday, and I get to start editing tonight. I'm really excited. And we recorded a video for Bad Thing, but I ended up actually changing the arrangements after we did the album, so it's an alternate version. We did a live video that we shot in Lower Manhattan, and I'm stoked about that. So I would advise people to keep an eye out for that video.
Ali Tadros speaking with Kaleidoscope host Juliette Fromholt. Tadros will perform tonight at Ghost Light Coffee in Dayton's South Park neighborhood.
Sweet on me, and I will fall like an avalanche to your cold bare feet. Mid-morning kisses your love.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of early spring. On this date many years ago, Buttercup, the family bulldog, and I were walking along the river into Mint Hollow. It was a rainy and windy afternoon, full of the scent of the thawing ground. I was thinking while I walked about spring and about Lent and about Easter coming, and then about my childhood Irish Catholic fasting and abstinence at this time of year. I practiced the yearly Catholic ritual until my early 20s, and then I took up something of Bertrand Russell's philosophy expressed so exquisitely in A Free Man's Worship. In Russell's vision of humanity cut off from the eternal, I found a brave defiance against death, and a noble alternative to an intrusive church. Against the powerful common sense of Russell's position and the majesty of his ideal, however, my childhood rhythms have returned. I find myself carefully tracking the old Catholic seasons with my outdated missals. I say the rosary now, and I invoke the saints the way my mother taught me. It's not really a social religion that I have, not anything I can pass on or down to anyone. It seems rather the triumph of emotion and illogic, the victory of an unshakable habit, possibly even of faith, over transitory reason. So anyway, that day years ago with Buttercup, the rain turned to sleet in Mint Hollow, and there was thunder, the first I'd heard all year, and the wind came up, and then snow started to fall in flakes so huge and so thick they hid the river. Buttercup the bulldog jumped at the noise, and her ears went back. She ran to me, scooted off up the path, and then zoomed back, confused and frightened. I knelt down, and I held her to me, stroked her head, and rubbed her back. I told her that what she heard was neither the reproach of a wrathful Irish god nor the ghastly roar of Bertrand Russell's fatal and indifferent universe. It was instead, I reassured her, the first wild and mighty call of the rising Christ of spring. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of early spring. In the meantime, walk the river in the thaws.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Thanks to everyone who phoned in their pledge of support to WYSO last week during our spring membership drive. We wrapped it up at about 8 o'clock this morning. Great success. And again, thanks to all of those who pledged by calling our phone number or pledging online. You can still do that at WYSO.org. Coming up next on WYSO, the Book Nook.